for a while, but there were enough there for me to address everyone. They needed a rousing speech, and I needed to feel like we were accomplishing something with this scheme. I tried to keep it short. Huh. I failed. I don't even remember what I said, but I recall I went on far too long. It was a good party. Bannermore had secured a small band of minstrels for the evening, and the Seven Door Inn supplied the feast, a continuous buffet of delicacies we'd soon be missing on the road. Ale flowed like the Bontal River, and we all got to know each other. There were blessings by the priestesses, solemn toasts by the Kasari, songs and stories from the War Magi, and ribald jokes from the Karshak. Everyone got drunk. I even recall Gareth kissing one of the priestesses at one point. I went to bed near dawn, feeling much better about the entire affair. It seems the one who needed a party most was me. But no one got stabbed, no one fought, and everyone was still enthusiastic once they'd met the others who would accompany them. After I recovered sufficiently from my hangover, one last run through our checklist and we were ready to go by that afternoon. For 100 people, transport through the waypoints would be difficult, but not impossible, for the 3 emissaries. With a bit of ceremony and production, we assembled in the inner bailey, gave everyone one last kiss goodbye, and then, with a lot of effort, were transported to the top of a very, very cold mountain. The Kasari were waiting for us, of course. 6 sturdy lads and 6 pretty maids, all in uniform, an honor guard to guide us to the settlement proper. The female equivalent of Kasari dress is also made of hemp cloth and embroidered, a short tunic and skirt. But the color of the costume was lighter, perhaps more feminine, while still appearing rustic. Instead of a neck cloth, the Kasari maids all wore sashes that seemed to indicate rank, or perhaps just daring skill at needlework, and each wore a perky and utterly non-functional cap. The Kasari seemed to be expecting a whole flock of falcons, or whatever a group of falcons is called, but Dara had brought only Frightful. It was decided that the other birds would not be brought over from the Mews in Sevendor and transformed until we were ready to go. After welcoming us and warming us with hot tea and honey at the High Lodge, they led our party down the mountain, past larger and more frequent buildings as we descended. At the bottom of the valley, set back away from the lake by a quarter mile and a few dozen feet in elevation, the main square of the Bransea settlement was packed with children. I could see them from the top of the mountain, crowding the square below. More, I could hear them. When you imagine 2,000 children between the ages of 8 and 13, you probably have no real conception about how loud that many kids can be, particularly if they are surrounded by crying parents and brothers and sisters who are worried about the long but necessary journey ahead of them. There was a lot of noise. We got a tantalizing look at the Kasari culture in cross-section as we descended Bransea Mountain, while the High Lodge, and what may have been temple facilities at the summit, demonstrated a serenity and appreciation of nature's abstract beauty. As we came down the winding trail, we were exposed to various other elements of Kasari life. From tiny little huts, where herbs and roots were dried and stored, to isolated cottages which seemed to grow old, wizened Kasari on their stoops, to small halls tucked away in blind landings or hollows, each dedicated to a specific task, and clearly labelled in Purwanese just what that task was. The halls seemed to be named, though the names were curious. Maywat Hall, Muir Hall, Baden Hall. No names from the Narasi that I could recognize, or anywhere else. Perhaps they were from our distant past. According to our guides, the Kasari had been inhabiting this region continuously for over 700 years. What was more curious was the spelling of the name in the many ancient signs in old Purwanese we saw. Bransea was spelled B-R-O-W-N-S-E-A. Phonetically the same, but the characters were different. I shrugged it off to the usual drift from antiquity. When we came to an overlook, our hosts bade us stop, reflect, observe, and rest before we continued down to the valley. The lake, I could see, was the center of the Bransea Kasari's culture. There were 7 or 8 little villages scattered along its edges. The lake served as a busy highway between the far-flung outposts. Canoes and rowboats paddled quickly across the pristine blue surface to gather at the main site. Few were fishing on this important day, but I could see a little island that seemed to be the center of that element of the lake's economy, with dozens of boats and nets pulled up on shore. In the distance, the great redwoods stood as a living curtain against the rest of the world. I could see why the Brancee defended this place so adamantly. It was, in its way, as sublime as the Alca Alon's citadels. We finally made it to the end of the trail, spilling out past a few large stone halls and wooden lodges, until we came to the large cobbled square in front of the Brancee Great Hall, and I could barely hear myself think, so many children had gathered there. The children were generally well-behaved. They were dressed in matching hempen tunics, trousers, boots, and their distinctive wool cloaks, and they all seemed to have the equipment the Kasari had promised me they would. Each one carried a bag of oiled treated leather or waxed hemp cloth, cunningly attached to a light wooden frame, worn on their backs with shoulder straps. The bags were sewn with a great variety of clever pockets and attachments, and no two seemed to be the same. Attached to each one also was a bedroll, and at the side of many of the packs were attached quivers and unstrung bows. Despite the seeming chaos, there was actually a lot of order to the mob. Five tall banner poles, each with a distinctive flag, complete with large Permanese numerals, were standing at regular points, gathering the folk assigned to each troop. Proctors of some sort were wandering through the crowd, parchment rolls in their hands, busily ensuring every child was placed in the right position. An older boy in each troop was responsible for admitting each child and checked them off a list they had been given. It was amazing how well organized you could be when everyone could read. The magi assigned to the troops were led to a massive hall, much larger than the high lodge above us. The great Brancee Hall, which boasted a cavernous interior the size of a big city temple, was no less than 3 stories high. It was ringed inside with sturdy wooden galleries on each level. It was impressive and ancient. A Kasari youth, a pretty maid, though her teeth were unfortunate to look at, led us daintily through the crowd toward a special table near the fireplace. The master's table, she called it. It was one huge section of giant redwood, at least 30 feet long, perfectly cut and brilliantly polished until you could see every gorgeous grain of wood. The hostess seated us around its vastness, in a surprisingly comfortable wooden chair. The Kasari masters were starting to arrive as I sat at my place and surveyed the crowd. The 5 masters I'd met were already there, and greeted me warmly and with little formality. More than 12 more eventually found seats around the huge table. Through some order I didn't understand, hundreds of Kasari filed in and found their seats. The volume of noise was more muted, in respect, I guessed, of the solemn occasion. Even that ceased when the portly, heavily bearded master of the council stood, leaning heavily on his sturdy staff, and gave the Kasari's sacred sign. In seconds, the entire room was quiet, as everyone there returned the sign. I'd say it was like magic, but it worked with far more ease and efficiency, in my professional opinion. "Join me in reciting your oath," the master boomed, maintaining the sign. What followed was a long prayer or invocation that the entire crowd solemnly spoke in near perfect unison. I had no idea what was being said, but it seemed to be ritual every Kasari knew by rote, from the youngest to the oldest. "Miskouten Adelgar," he finished, dropping the sign. Everyone relaxed too, but continued to stand and silently attend. Good gods, how did they get everyone to do that? "Today we welcome our new friend, Minelan the Spellmonger," he began in a deep, resonant voice, gesturing to me unexpectedly. I rose and let myself be recognized, waving with my pipe stem with what I hoped was a friendly smile. "In fulfillment of his agreement for our help in the south last year, he has consented to escort our youth from our council lands here, through the southern wilderness and the towns of the Narasi, to the Kasar Council lands, our most ancient. Miskouten Dibnadwy, our thanks to our Narasi friend, who keeps his agreements." There was a brief shout of, "Mes Sculptin Dibonadwe," that I assumed was directed at me and was intended to be admiration, thanks, or respect. The master of the council went on, as his folk calmed and remained attentive. "Would the Govani tribes return to the hills from whence they once were driven by the Narasi? Our southern frontier is no longer safe. The Govani in the Kulins have been stirred against us, barricading our ancient, secret paths through the mountains. The shadow of abomination stirs them against us and shows no signs of waning. Our guard is strong, and few raiders come through our line. But with each passing month, the danger grows greater. We could stand at Brunsi until the seas came to claim our land," he said, his voice filling the hall proudly. It took me a moment to realize how he was doing it, without magic. But then I realized that the entire place was built acoustically so that a voice spoken from that exact spot would be heard by most of the hall. I did a few quick and subtle magical spells to check my theory, and was pleased to see I was correct. I was impressed. That indicated a level of sophistication far beyond a simple arboreal tribe. The Kasari might have technically been barbarians, but they weren't savages. "Our fastness here is secure, and our blood is tied to this mountain. But it is not safe for our children here any more. 7 times since the invasion, our youth have been beset by Govani raiders. 7 times we have held burial rites for our children. We are strong at Brunsi, but without our most vulnerable to worry about, Brunsi will become stronger. So has ruled the council." He turned and faced the mass of parents who had gathered off to his left. "It is customary, once a child has seen 6 summers and proved his vigor, to enroll him in our earliest rites. The importance of this cannot be understated. There they learn to aspire to excellence in all things, the fundamental tenet of our rites. Gwenashkaru! Gwenashkaru!" came the thunderous response from every Kasari there. "Yet a child cannot learn and train if he fears attack. With our kin in Kasar, the mother council of Filmon, our children will get the chance to grow strong and learn our ways far from the Govani threat. Though it is painful for us to send them away, it is what is best for both them and the Kasari people. We owe them our best," he reminded the weeping parents there. "Gwenech Guru," they replied in unison again, although more muted. "To our youth, who are fearful of leaving their homes and taking such a frightening and long journey, I tell you this, how I envy you the adventure ahead. Not in many lifetimes has such a feat as this trek been attempted. My scout endure. You will begin this journey as children, but you will end it as men and women in many ways, advanced by experience ahead of those who learn only through the rites. To you comes the challenge of the greatest of tests, a trial no council could have arranged for you. With your knowledge and training to inform you, your leaders to guide you, and your fellowship to sustain you, your ordeal will be transformative. My scouts and there, the Kasari are strong, and this journey is the quest the gods have tasked you with. You are ready for it." The children didn't just issue a rote response. They burst into a wildly enthusiastic outpouring of affirmation. If there were any scared kids there, I certainly didn't see them. My eyes grew larger, despite myself, at the sheer volume and enthusiasm. I had 2 of these at home now. Sure, they were cute. But was this maelstrom of frenetic energy to be my future? And I had nearly 2,000 of these tykes to watch over for months. Goblins I could conquer. Dragons and dark lords I could survive. But this? It occurred to me that this journey would be transformative for more than just the kids. The master gave the sign again, and again, like magic, everyone was quiet in an instant. I had to learn how he did that. He continued, "I encourage you to treat it as the adventure it is, but also realize that it is a very grave quest. You must be prepared. You must keep yourself strong. You must keep yourself awake and aware, and you must keep your feet on the path you know to be right. To our new friends, he continued, facing me, but addressing the knot of magi, priestesses and attendants we'd brought through the ways, I give you our thanks. We understand, perhaps more than you do, the danger you face and the magnitude of the task ahead. The Wilderlands are no longer as peaceful as they were under the Narasi conquest, and many evil things that have lain quiet have awakened again. Yet we would not attempt it if we didn't know it was possible, likely, even, that you would succeed. Our relations with the Narasi have been complicated. We appreciate the assistance you have lent in negotiating our passage with the Wilderlords. I swallowed and just smiled and nodded. It was a work in progress, after all, and I did have a piece of parchment signed by the exiled lord of this broken realm that technically gave me permission, at least to the border of Castal. So, tomorrow, at dawn, the troops will be mustered in Brancis Square. There, after appropriate devotions, we will begin the journey with final inspection, benediction, and goodbyes. 3 troops of rangers will accompany the march as far as Otter's Point, the frontier of our lands. Beyond that, the gods and a single troop of rangers will escort you. The spellmonger will be your leader, and I expect all to give him his due. My skulls and fed. Tonight we dine in fellowship one last time in this sacred hall. Let us rest, relax, and enjoy ourselves with food, merriment, story and song, until we meet again around some other fire, in some other place. For now, let us eat. My skulls and adulgar. With that solemn blessing in their own language, the feast began, with hundreds of dishes being served to each table by a legion of maidens, many of whom were destined to join us on our journey. They brought large cast-iron pots of various mixtures of meat and vegetables, and laid them on the table with a spoon. The Kasari ate from common dishes, serving themselves in their own personal bowls, knives and spoons. Large earthenware jugs of cider, tea and weak ale were also served, and every Kasari furnished their own cup or horn. There was no precedence as to who ate first. Everyone was extremely polite, and there was no fighting over anything. People sat and ate and chatted casually, without the formality of Narasi table service. I mean, I kept a fairly casual hall, but there was some order to it. Here, all the dishes were served at once. Porridge, meat, vegetables, bread, dessert, and it was left to the diner to determine what, when, and how much. It was odd, but as it turns out, I quickly became accustomed to the Kasari dining style. Pentandra and Arborn were also seated at the long redwood table. No accident that they were sitting together. Penny didn't even have to bribe anyone, I found out. The Kasari don't take bribes. She just asked if she could move and got a smile and a nod. You think our chances of avoiding battle are good, Arborn? I asked, after finishing an excellent duck stew, by mopping it up with a fairly mediocre heel of bread. At first, I mean. We should have no foes at hand for the first few days, while we are within our own frontiers, he agreed, after a moment's consideration. I've spoken to all the rangers who have returned from our outposts. So far there appears to be little movement of Gavani in the southern hills.
I'm hoping we can slip by the tribal Gavani quietly, agreed Pentandra. Of all the potential enemies we might face, they seem to be the most easily driven off. Where I'm worried is once we get down into the former Wilderlord's territory, in the penumbra proper, the Gavani there are far more disciplined, better armed and better led, from what the scouts say.
Since when did you become a tactician, Penny? I asked her, mind to mind.
I can read a dispatch, you know, and I spoke with Terlaman and the other war magi, who actually fight more than once a year, about conditions along the way.
I let it go. She was trying to impress her big, manly man. It was cute. I have contingencies for that, I assured the table. Just get us through the forests and to the roads, and I'll take it from there. I hoped I sounded confident. I wasn't feeling confident. I was seriously wondering if I could pull this off. If I had doubts, they really set in after dinner, when the parents began speaking to me. I spoke to well over 100 Kasari parents that night, and I saw the grief on their faces over what they were doing. In their position, I realized
I'd be similarly stricken. They were essentially consigning the fate of their child to a complete stranger, a flashy-looking mage from the Southlands who they didn't know. How would I act toward a strange wizard who wanted to take Minalion and Almina away from me? With equal solemnity, I assured each and every one that I would do everything in my power to ensure their child would be safe. I meant it, each and every time. It was exhausting. Finally, after the children had been dismissed to the square where they were all bedding down for the night to test their new equipment and learn their assigned roles, the great hall cleared out, and only the older Kasari were left. Each of the various masters, and there were over 24, met and spoke with me, giving me advice about the wild, the countryside, the Gavani, and how to deal with that many children. I tried to absorb it all, but I was starting to feel overwhelmed when one of those hostesses appeared and offered to show me to my lodging for the night. I took her up on it. We were rising before dawn, and the unbearable burden of responsibility for the lives of 2,000 children was pressing down on me. Could I do this? Would I do this? Leading troops into battle was one thing, fighting dragons another. But a mission where the goal wasn't to meet the foe and triumph, but to avoid the foe and survive? Could I manage that? A lot of parents just like me were counting on me to do just that. The portly master of the council must have discerned my anxiety, despite my clever attempt to hide it under a confident smile. He sought me out later that evening when we were both outside seeking the peace of a pipe. "So, are you nervous?" he asked me as he puffed his pipe to life. "I'm excited," I conceded. "It's a big day tomorrow." "It's all right to be nervous, son," he said in a comforting, paternal way. "We understand how hard a task this is. We appreciate your commitment to it. But along the way, you're going to find challenges you won't believe you'll be able to handle. Situations that get out of control. Even tragedy and calamity. We Kasari know what can happen in the field." "So, do you have any advice for me?" I asked, not too proud to ask a man who clearly knew how to lead. He thought for a moment and shrugged. "Gwene'ish Guru." "I'm sorry. I haven't learned much Kasari yet," I said. "It's the very first lesson we teach all of our children," he explained without condescension. "It's a guiding principle when you struggle with doubt and chaos. Gwene'ish Guru. It is all we expect of them. It means, do your best. Do your best, spellmonger, and all else will fall into place. That is all anyone can ask of any man." I fell asleep to the sound of the kids singing some song in Kasari out in the square. They sounded cheerful and hopeful, and not at all like they were being led to certain doom at the hands of a sinister wizard. I tried to pin my hopes on that. Rondal shook me awake the next morning at dawn. He was already dressed and ready, an anxious look on his face as he bade me rise, dress, and prepare myself. I splashed some water on my face, used the chamber pot, dressed, and ventured down the stairs to the square, where 2,000 choruses of "Good morning" in Kasari pelted my ears. I was just as happy that the Kasari don't go in for brewing and distilling the way that other tribes in the region do. Facing that many squealing voices with a hangover would have been problematic. It took an hour for everyone to pack up, another hour to eat breakfast and prepare themselves. By the time the sun had risen over the eastern ridges, all 2,000 children had sorted themselves out into their various troops. I took my place along with Pentandra in Troop 3, my pack on my back and my knees weak, feeling like I was in the army for the first time again. "Oh, shit," I thought to myself, "we're really going to do this. And I'm in charge." Before I could find some magical way to escape, Captain Arborn showed up near our banner-bearer, an earnest lad of 12 named Darman, dressed for ranging with an oversized pack on his back. From his leather trousers to his stout boots to his long wilderland's bow of laminated hickory and yew, he was ready to fade into the foliage and deal silent death to anyone who got in our way. That made me feel better. I like the forest, but I like the nice, calm, tame woodlands of the Westwood in Sevendor more than the wild, dangerous depths of the Wilderlands. Having a doughty ranger like Arborn around made me feel better.
I just got the call from the first outpost, Spellmonger. He reported, the way is clear, and they say to send the Pathfinders forward. Once they make it to the outpost, they'll continue on and we'll send the second troop. As soon as they're ready, give the order. I agreed. Last goodbyes, and if anyone has to pee, now is the time. He smiled and threw me a Kasari salute. I was going to get used to that very quickly, I discovered. The Kasari salute more than trained soldiers do, and use a variety of clever hand signals to communicate other things. I looked forward to learning them. The first troop yelled in joy when they heard the news. They began singing a tune in Kasari and lined up in tight formation, four abreast, their packs and bows on their backs. Tyndall grinned at me and confirmed the order, mind to mind, and then Arborn commanded the march. Using the song as their cadence, the boys began moving. I got called back to Troop 5 to negotiate a dispute between Landric and Ormar when the call for Troop 2 to move out came. This time I heard a horn. The Kasari preferred a small curved brass horn and had just as many unique action calls as they did hand signals, and Rondal checked with me before the troop began to move. With a lot of cheering and waving, they departed the square after their fellows. I stopped by Troop 4 to make certain that the Hessians didn't have any last-minute concerns, and then I made it back to Troop 3 just in time to get the word. Troop 1 had made it to the second outpost. Troop 2 had made it to the first. It was our turn. Troop 3's ranger captain, a tall fellow named Gaius, who was a veteran of the Poros campaign, grinned at me as he hoisted his own oversized pack on his back like it was nothing. I returned the grin but didn't feel particularly enthusiastic about the long walk ahead. I remember marching in the military. I remember the long march, down the coast of Faris and through its deadly jungles. At least this time, I wasn't doing it in full armor, with people trying to kill me every step of the way. It was just a pleasant little walk, I reasoned, with around 400 reasonably well-behaved adolescents. I heard the marchmaster give a certain call on the twisted brass horn, the banner-bearer took up his pole, and suddenly we were marching. Shouts and cries and mad waves all conspired to keep me from doing anything but focusing on the rank ahead of me. Even though I was in charge, and toward the front, the Kasari had very specific ideas about how to march, so I was four ranks back. My feet trod the cobbles of the square until we left through a simple wooden arch, and then the trail was well-beaten earth. It was a lovely morning for a walk. The village at the edge of the square was made up of row upon row of neat, well-constructed cottages, I saw, with stone foundations and rough log frames. There was absolutely no attempt to distinguish one from the other, and at first I wondered how anyone knew where anything was, when every house looks more or less like every other one. Then I passed by a cot, closely enough to look, and realized that the resident's name and rank were written neatly in old Perwanese on each door. Another advantage of a literate people, I concluded. That wasn't to say that the Kasari did not decorate. Just about every cot had some carved animal or bird or fish on it, in homage to some totemic animal. But the designs were subdued, part of the decoration, not idols to be worshipped. Soon enough we passed through the little townlands and into the forest itself. Even then we saw little huts and cots scattered throughout the woods, and the rangers took the time to explain which ones were spring houses, which were herb houses, and which were buildings of other utility. The path wound through the forest naturally, with the lay of the land, but was lined on either side by a neat row of stones. In places where the land rose or fell, neat little steps had been cut into the grade, secured with staked logs to help your footing. But beyond the trail, the wild of the forest was allowed to grow unhindered. An hour into the trip, just after we reached the first outpost, I started to sweat. 2 hours into it, when we arrived at the second outpost, my feet were starting to cramp, and I was getting thirsty. My shoulders were starting to ache. I was starting to breathe hard. I filled my water bottle, drained it into my thirsty mouth, and then refilled it from the cool, clear spring at the outpost. Not nearly long enough later, we plunged back onto the trail, already hearing the sounds of Troop 4 off in the distance behind us. "This is fun," Penny said as she caught up to me. She was sweating too,
and her pack had to be half the size of mine. I'm sure she'd made use of the pocket stone, too. She'd tied her long black hair back under a Kasari-style head kerchief, which she used to mop her brow as she stopped.
But, a little tiring,
she admitted. It's the pack, I suggested, and the altitude. Once we're in thicker air, it will get better. I'd had that problem in the mountains of Faris. Bovol Vale, too, actually. You adjust.
It's good for my skin,
she said, trying to put a good face on the exertion.
And my body. Arborne says Kasari women are all strong women, she added pleasantly.
That got my attention instantly. Pentandra had that tone. The Penny is talking like she's in a trance tone. I remember it well, from the time she'd drafted me for a sustained experiment in sex magic that had lasted most of 3 days. When Penny gets that tone about something, it means she's become successfully obsessed and fundamentally committed to that obsession. I knew no amount of clear reason would get her mind off it. They certainly produce strong children, I noted, nodding toward the rank of kids ahead of us. All boys. They were chatting away gaily without a drop of sweat on them. They have at least twice as much in their packs as you do.
They also have the vigor of youth,
complained Penny, puffing with exertion.
Damn them.
We made the fourth outpost by noon and took a break for lunch. We didn't have to use Gareth's supplies yet, as the Kasari had stockpiled freshly made food for us for the first few days. We ate sausages and biscuits, and more cool, clear water. I lay down on my back and heaved my chest, happy not to have my pack on for a few glorious moments. And then we were moving again. I was exhausted and resenting the comforts of nobility when we made it to the seventh outpost that night. A treehouse, akin to the Alka Alon, but in a Kasari style. Dinner was set for us there, with 100 iron kettles of food, hot and ready when we finally arrived an hour after dusk. By then, even the boys were tired, and the leaders of each unit had to quiet them down when they started complaining. We bedded down around a few dozen fires in camps the Kasari rangers had prepared. Instead of sleeping in one large group, however, I was introduced to my patrol. Every Kasari had been assigned to a patrol to keep them organized. There were generally 10 children to a patrol, with each of them taking turns carrying an iron kettle, its lid, and an extra skin of water, as well as a kit of additional supplies that belonged to the patrol. You ate with your patrol, marched with your patrol, and slept in the same camp as your patrol. It was a lot like army organization in some ways, without the burden of guard duty. The rangers were doing that for us, for now. Each adult was assigned to a patrol. While they weren't exactly servants, the children were the ones responsible for cooking and serving our food, then cleaning up, always submitting their work for our approval. It was apparently a special honor to be in the Spellmonger's patrol, because I overheard one of my boys bragging about it to a patrol with a mere ranger. I became intimately familiar with my patrol over the course of the next few days. Owen, Larry, Nazar, Trav, Cage, Artlan, Dom, Shan, Ven, and Vis. Shan was the oldest, at 14, and Vis was the youngest, at 11. For the next several weeks, they were my near-constant companions, always willing to run errands, deliver messages, and listen to my stories. A great group of boys, despite their individual idiosyncrasies. Kasari boys are still boys, after all. Penny was assigned to one of 4 all-girl patrols, which were kept toward the center of the group. Not that they were helpless. I saw several who carried bows the same as the older boys. But that was the Kasari way, and this was a Kasari march. And it was just the beginning of the adventure. Chapter 10 The Redwoods of Brancy. Waking up in a forest, the dew wet on your face, is always disconcerting. Doing so surrounded by 400 children was novel.
"Breakfast, Master Minilin,"
little Vis said, bringing me a wooden bowl of porridge from the pot over the fire.
"The Trekmaster has said we depart in 20 minutes."
I thought I was the Trekmaster, but the Kasari had an official title for the person who decides when it was time to get moving, and I was surprised that it wasn't me. It was a 13-year-old in Patrol 1. I hadn't even been consulted. I ate my porridge and drank the strong tea Vis brought me a moment later, and the next thing I knew it was time for inspection. I had all 10 of the boys lined up, and I hadn't even peed yet. I did the best I could, following the Kasari maxim. I gulped my meal, looked over the boys' costumes, though I could find nothing amiss, listened to them recite something in Kasari that I nodded approvingly about, but didn't understand, and then dismissed them to break down the camp, which they did in a remarkably short time. By the time I had gotten back from a required trip into the underbrush, they were standing around in their packs, staves in hand, ready to go. In fact, they were waiting on me. I hurriedly packed up my own gear, cursing myself silently for easy living and the soft beds of Sevendor. I needed toughening, I decided. I started to get angry with myself as I reflected on all of the comforts I'd surrounded myself with in the last few years. Yes, I'd faced a dragon, a lot of dragons, and more than a couple of hordes of bloodthirsty goblins, even an army of my neighbors, which was novel. But those had been relatively brief moments of exertion in an otherwise sedentary life. I rode horses now. Hells, I took the Alcan ways instead of crossing distances like normal people.
Menelan, what the hells have you done to me?
Moaned Penny's mind into mine.
My entire body aches. I got no sleep. Those girls talked all night long.
I chuckled to myself and tried to keep it out of my head. I sympathize. These boys are entirely too energetic. Try not to kill anyone for irritating you too much. Your light love probably wouldn't like it.
He'd never find the body, she promised.
We were indeed ready to march in a surprisingly short time. A call on the horn and we were forming up in ranks again, the banner-bearer at the head of the line. I wasn't even awake yet, and my legs were moving. My feet were pounding forward. My legs were going up and down. We were marching. I tried desperately not to think about it. The forest was lovely and lush in the morning, the dim light barely filtering through the thick canopy. There were big trees, larger than any in Sevendor's small forests, oaks, aspens, hickories, ashes, and dozens of varieties I was unfamiliar with. There were birds and bugs and small mammals and lizards and things I couldn't identify. The underbrush was sparse, limited to clumps of holly and occasional meadows, thick with shrubs. Otherwise it was just tree after tree, as far as the eye could see, uphill and downhill. After an hour on the trail I started to get the feeling that we were in an endless forest. I spent my time in contact, mind to mind, with the Magi and the other troops. The Pathfinders were plunging ahead. Tyndall enthusiastically relayed, and Arborn reported through him that the rangers had detected no activity along the frontier of the forest. The folk of Carmella's troop were complaining about the amount of extra equipment they had to carry, but that was the extent of the problems. Then we crossed over a cataract and across a boulder field, and I saw the great redwoods for the first time. The trees towered overhead, dwarfing the forest behind us. They blotted out the sun, their canopies so high they harbored mists in tight little clumps, as if the trees were growing clouds as fruit. It was amazing, akin to the wonder I'd felt at seeing the Alka Alon's groves, but far more majestic. It was as close as I've had to a divine experience since my daughter was born, and that included meeting a goddess. They were filled with birds, thousands of them in each tree. We continued walking toward them, their trunks impossibly large and growing larger with each step. When we breached the edge of the grove, they stood taller than towers above us. I gawked more than the children around me at the sight, and the patrol behind me gently urged me forward. It was less like walking through a forest, and more like walking in a land of impossibly tall towers. The great redwood forest, I was told by one of the boys, then, I think, stretched for miles ahead of us. Only the Kasari had been permitted to walk here in many, many years, he informed me. I felt honored and awed by the great trees. I did my best to ask dozens of questions, which the boys were only too happy to answer, and observe everything I could. They seemed incredibly knowledgeable about them, and the species that lived in and on and around them. That evening we came to a narrow but deep river that cut through the valley from the north, turning into a bit of a waterfall, and pooling into a small lake before continuing on. I knew from reports from Tyndall and Rondell that their troops had stopped for the night among the trees on the slope ahead. The river looked like a good place to camp to me, and setting up camp before the sun completely went down sounded like an indulgence. That, of course, inspired a lot of splashing and bathing, as the children washed the dust and dirt from their faces. I contacted Gareth to prepare to send us dinner, and I took off my boots before gratefully dangling them into the icy cold stream. I almost regretted it, until the cold began to numb my sore, tired feet. The spells and enchantments in my boots had helped a lot, but we had done nearly 40 miles in 2 days. Even magic has its limits. A moment later I had a guest. Penny nearly flung down her boots and plunged her feet into the rippling water, an expression of pain and relief washing over her sweaty, dirty face. Her hair was now plaited into the same long braid all of the Kasari girls wore, with her kerchief tied under her chin. She looked exhausted, sweaty, unkempt, and absolutely adorable. "How are you doing?" I asked, casually but warily. I braced for a litany of complaint that didn't come.
"I'm surviving,"
she said, after a few too many moments of silence.
"I'm getting used to the pace, at least. Good choice for a campsite. The girls were thrilled."
"No bathing," I reminded her. The Trek Master had very specific instructions on just where and when the children could bathe. The Kasari had very wholesome but conservative ideas about sex, which I imagined was getting to Penny.
"I know," she replied glumly. "I wasn't thinking of bathing. Oh, I could use a bath, no doubt. But I like the river nearby. It makes the trees seem less intimidating."
"I don't think anything could be less intimidating in this forest. How long must they have grown here? Why did they grow so large? Was there magic involved?"
"Not any direct magic, I think. Though this has the feel of the Alka Alon," she conceded. "But this is natural, not supernatural. Each tree is like a miniature forest of its own, like a coral reef on the land. It's amazing, but intimidating."
"I've never felt more insignificant in my life," I agreed, "and that includes meeting a couple of dukes, a couple of dragons, and the dead god."
"You can see why the Kasari are anxious to protect them," she nodded. "They are sublime, worthy of protecting. Perhaps that's why our ancestors set the Kasari here in the first place. To protect the redwoods. Just a theory," she added.
We'd been playing this game since we'd started associating with the Kasari, me for strategic reasons, her for romantic ones. But we were both fascinated by the Kasari claim to be among the first of humanity to settle Kalidor. There were enough oddities in their culture to merit suspicion of such a thing, we both agreed. No other race we knew was completely literate, for example. No other culture had seemingly abolished class based on wealth. The fact that they used old Perwanese, as well as their own language, certainly suggested their ancient origins. Perwin was on the other side of the continent and half an ocean from Brancy, but all the writing I'd seen used in Brancy was in the ancient language. But those trees convinced me more than anything up to then. If I were our ancestors, come to a new world, I would set a watch on their majesty and protect their groves. I would make a race, much like the Kasari, in other words, to protect something so sacred. That night was the first major test of our supply rods, and they worked as we had anticipated. After confirming with Gareth that it was ready and secured in the extra-dimensional space, I invoked the command word on a flat bit of rock near the river, and a moment later an entire cauldron of food, surrounded by thick loaves of the most excellent bread in the world, my dad's, appeared out of nowhere. There was a second of pause, while the eyes of the Kasari children grew wide. Then all hell broke loose as they cheered the magical feast. It was a thick bean soup, liberally supplied with chunks of smoked pork, onions, potatoes, and a lot of garlic. Each patrol sent a member with the patrol's cauldron and brought back a potful. It was delicious. After 2 days of walking and eating trail rations, I devoured every hot morsel, soaking up the excess with a chunk of delicious bread. Thankfully, Gareth had included a jug of good, strong Riverlands ale for me, too. I didn't have the Kasari's wholesome attitude toward alcohol, and after 2 days without so much as a cup of watered wine, I felt I deserved it. Besides, it made the perfect complement to the soup. I enjoyed draining my drinking horn, a highly scrimshawed parting gift from the Master of the Council immensely, and belched onions, garlic, beer, and beans, while my feet enjoyed the luxury of not feeling like feet in the cold, cold stream. Penny and I talked until the stars came out, quietly passing a flask of pear brandy she'd smuggled into the march between us. That night, I slept a dreamless sleep, inspired by weariness and encouraged by brandy. The next morning, I was loath to put my sweaty boots back on. Toward noon on the third day, I was afforded a rare opportunity. We passed by a Kasari ranger post among the giant redwoods, and I got invited to go to the top and take in the view. In a land with such massive trees, building a tower to watch over them was futile. Instead, the Kasari pressed the trees themselves into service. I almost declined when I saw the rope ladder they lowered down to us. That was a really long ladder, yet its length was a bare fraction of the tree it descended from. I could see the head of the man who lowered the ladder peek over the side of a small platform that had been built into the side of the great tree. The sudden sense of scale was dizzying, as I realized just how much further the tree extended above him. Still, I couldn't exactly say no to climbing the largest trees in the world. That wouldn't be wizardly. How often do you get a chance like that? I smiled and followed the ranger guide up the long rope ladder until my fingers stung almost as much as my feet hurt. But I finally made it to the platform, Penny and Sir Festaran behind me. It was impressive. We were more than 4 stories above the forest floor, about as tall as my tower, and I could see a surprisingly long way through the forest. That's when Penny tapped me on the shoulder.
"What are you waiting for?"
she asked. I didn't know what she meant until I saw the basket. A well-constructed wooden basket, with 3 protruding beams that formed the tripod overhead, was sitting on the edge of the platform. She sighed, walked around me and got in. There was room for 4, if we scrunched in, and our ranger guide pushed in behind us before securing the entry with a rope. He grinned and looked up. So did I. That's when I saw the other rope, tied to the apex of the basket where the 3 beams came together. It was a thick knot, the rope thick enough to support a bridge. It extended up through the canopy above, until it disappeared among the boughs. With a sickening realization, I understood what was happening. I even started to wonder just how they were planning on doing it, with that perfectly rational and analytical part of my mind, before the purely emotional part started to loudly object to the possibility. That's when the world suddenly fell out from my feet, and I was flying upward. It was a splendidly rapid ascent, once my stomach caught up with me. We traveled up the rope, past layer after layer of forest, the giant redwood trunk next to us gradually growing smaller in width as we rose. A burst of birds fled above us as we ascended, thousands of avian voices objecting to the interruption in their working day, as our basket hurtled through their flocks. Halfway up, we sped past the counterbalance, a giant log, 40 feet or more in length, plunging toward the ground, suspended by the other end of the rope we were suspended from. Suddenly that rope didn't really look all that thick anymore. Our ascent slowed slightly, then much more abruptly, until we popped through a hole in the floor of the actual ranger's lookout. With trembling hands and a twisted stomach, I gratefully took the hand of the smiling young ranger who helped me out of the basket. We proved to be on a landing deck built onto the side of a great platform built directly onto the tree. I looked around frantically, looking to ensure we were secure, a natural response that I'm not ashamed of. What I saw made me feel better. This hall in the sky wasn't going anywhere. The canopy of the mighty tree at this level was formed of 2 gigantic boughs that extended northwest and southwest of the tree's trunk for over 50 feet. A giant deadfall, a smaller dead branch fallen from above, had wedged itself across the 2 great boughs, locked in by a tangle of entwined branches. The Kasari had made use of this natural formation by lashing the boughs together with some of that massive rope, and then covering the resulting triangle with a long, sturdy flooring of other branches, mere sticks and twigs compared to the great branches they were bound to. Instead of a roof supported by the platform, the Kasari had used an overhanging bough, one could consider small only by comparison, and stretched a wide hempen tarpaulin over it, securing it with ropes to protect their outpost from rain and snow. Inside the arboreal hall, an iron stove, cast in the shape of a large acorn, allowed the rangers to cook and heat. The tree provided plenty of firewood in the form of deadfall. I could see by the number of squirrel and rakiel pelts hanging from the hall that the watchers did not even have to leave their treetop nest to hunt. Indeed, the entire canopy was thick with wildlife.
"Oh, Menelan, look,"
Penny said, sucking her breath. I turned around to see what she was looking at, and all the redwood forest was spread out before me. Thanks to the height of the tree we were in, relative to the ones lower down the slope of the mountain, we had a nearly unimpeded view of the land to the south beyond the edge of the forest, all the way to the grey hills on the horizon. As watchtowers go, this one was extremely useful. Even without mage sight, you could clearly see the approach to the forest for miles. With mage sight, you could have spotted a single goblin. The Kasari didn't have mage sight, but they did have spy glasses. That was a pretty sophisticated device for a bunch of tribals. It turned out that basic optics are taught to the higher-ranked Kasari, who also employed mirrors and lanterns for signalling. They also used flares, smoke, secret signs, bird calls, and other means of communicating. But the most impressive one of all was also one of the simplest. This outpost was one of the many along this line, it was explained, as I watched with fascination as a ranger climbed to a platform on the roof bough, bearing two banners, one in each hand. I thought perhaps that they would signal with flags, as ships at sea do, but instead the man began to stand in a series of poses, the bright yellow banners extending at arm's length in different positions. The next tree outpost over had a man in a similar position watching the signals. "So, each position has a particular meaning?" I asked, intrigued. "Each position is a particular letter," Penny explained smugly. "The Kasari are all literate. Each position represents one letter, so a simple sentence can be communicated from one tower to another. The ranger who watches calls out the letters to a recorder, who writes them down on parchment. But you can communicate an entire order that way, just like reading a letter. Each station passes the message down the line to the next, until it reaches its destination." "That's amazing," I nodded. "And they do it all without magic.
Just literacy," she shrugged. "Do you see why I like this culture?"
"And Arborn does tend to epitomize it," I agreed. "But this, I can see all sorts of uses for this technique. And it explains how the Brancy Kasari are always able to mobilize so quickly, for being so dispersed." The main Brancy settlement we had started from was the cultural and administrative center of the Sacred Groves, true. But according to our guides, most of the Brancy Kasari lived in small communities or isolated settlements scattered throughout their lands. But every time the Wilderlords attempted to steal into the forest after the Great Redwoods, expecting a little local resistance, easily chased away by their knights, the Kasari would suddenly pour hundreds of cunning archers down on them far faster than the Alshari expected. It had always been blamed on bad luck, poor leadership, or some tribal black magic. But the Kasari flag code explained how they were able to get so many of their folk to arms and directed at the enemy so quickly and quietly. "I wonder how far off the ground we are," I mused.
591 feet,
Sir Festaren replied automatically, in a hoarse voice. I'd almost forgotten the young knight was there, but his big ears and curly black hair were right behind me. "Oh, that's a lot," I admitted. I tried to remember if I'd ever been this high up without a mountain under me. Nothing was coming to mind. "I can see why this would be a strategically important site," I nodded. You can see for miles in each direction.
4¾ miles to the east, 6⅓ miles to the west,
Festaren agreed, his voice louder, but still a little shaky.
Over 11 miles of observable territory.
That was even more impressive. With the flag-waving system, I could see how a few of these treehouses, in strategic spots, would be an ideal warning system. And the Kasari had more than a few of them. There were 12 rangers stationed at this station alone, with another 6 out patrolling the frontier.
"What if there's an incursion?"
Penny asked our guide. "A couple of trolls with axes and those big bronze shields they carry would be hard to defend against from up here," she noted, glancing over the railing to the ground below.
"They've tried," the ranger chuckled. "Aye, as did the Narasi before them. We used the same tactic. There are caches of deadwood up here, mostly for firewood, but also for defence. The trolls who tried it last year got a couple of logs on their heads. And we can descend the tree quickly, at need," he continued, nodding toward a long coil of rope hanging from the far side of the roof bough. "We can even go most of the way down and shoot at them from the air. Believe me, this outpost is tougher than it looks."
Coming down was just as impressive as going up. When we had our feet on the dirt again, we couldn't even see the outpost above us. Except for the 400 children gathered around the trunk, a passerby would not have been able to tell the difference between the outpost tree and any of the dozens of others in sight. Something else that was impressive was dinner. The cauldron transport spells worked splendidly, and the big iron kettle, full of chicken stew and cornbread, instantly filled the encampment at the base of the tree with a delicious smell, enticing enough to bring a few rangers down from the treetop to join us. There was plenty, of course, and I sent the remainder back up with our guests for the on-duty rangers to enjoy. A wave of the supply rod and the empty pot was returned to Talry. That night we slept peacefully, and I placed only the most cursory of wards around our camp before checking in with Alia by mirror, blowing kisses at the kids in the tiny bit of glass I could see them through, and going to sleep. The next morning, we got up at dawn and enjoyed another kettle of porridge before getting back on the trail. That was a long day, because the next truly safe place for us to stop was another ranger outpost known as the Overlook, on the other side of the Redwood Forest, 17 miles southeast of where we woke up. That's a long, hard hike through rough country, even with the trails the Kasari had developed over the centuries. We only stopped for 30 minutes rest and luncheon at noon, then pushed on until a little after dark. I had the various magi in each troop use mage lights, even though they might attract some stray goblin attention, because I would rather get to a safe spot in enough time to avoid danger than blunder around in the darkness and stumble into it. The Overlook, as we discovered the next morning, was a high cliff that, you guessed it, overlooked the first big valley to the east of the Kasari lands proper. Since the invasion, the Narasi homesteads that had been there had been deserted, their residents fled, dead or enslaved. The Overlook allowed the Kasari a bit of visible presence, warning both Narasi wilderlords and Gavani warriors of their presence, and the dangers of intruding over their borders. A pyramid of rotting goblin heads at the bottom of the trail gave testament to that. The Overlook outpost itself was old, though not as ancient as the Bramsea Mountain settlement. A squat, 3-story stone building stood at the top of a rocky path, narrow enough to be defended by a single man, if he knew what he was doing. Plenty of convenient places to shoot from gave the trail that much more cover. It wasn't a castle in any real sense, but it was a very defendable spot in a strategic location. The Kasari had stationed almost 100 rangers there in anticipation of our passing through, but normally there were at least 50. My patrol explained to me that the Overlook was one of the main ranger stations, commanded by one of the masters, and the point from which most of the ranger missions and patrols on the eastern side of the lands began. The little hall even had a stable, and a kennel. I didn't think much of that last. The Kasari absolutely love dogs, and hunt voraciously. But when my troop woke up the next morning, still tired after the push we'd made the day before, it was to the sight of 12 hounds bounding across the compound, leaping over several boys at a time as they did so. That's easy to do when you're the size of a horse.
The sled dogs,
Pentandra said, snapping her fingers.
The ones we transgenically enchanted.
We really didn't turn many of them back after the battle, I admitted, a little guiltily. Not that the dogs were in any kind of pain or discomfort with their